Look, Daddy, I like you.
Like? I like you!
That's the thing, I like you too.
Daddy!
There's a lot of things about me you don't know anything about, Daddy. Things you wouldn't understand. Things you couldn't understand. Things you shouldn't understand.
I don't understand.
TBTL.
Guess what day it is? Guess what day it is?
It's Friday. Friday. Gotta get down on Friday. Everybody's looking forward to the weekend.
There are two types of people in this world. Those who like Neil Diamond and those who don't. My ex-wife loves him.
You know something? That was pretty funny. You should think about being a comedian.
My friend is a blackjack dealer, and on his forearm he has a tattoo of an ace and a jack. You see, I'm a blackjack player. On my forearm, I'm going to get a tattoo of a 10 and a 2. And then maybe later, a king.
You know how someone might describe a situation that's unpleasant or confining as being like a prison? This is what they're referring to.
Well, all right. Hello, good morning, and welcome, everybody, to a Friday edition of TBTL, the show that just might be too beautiful to live.
Is this a thing people care about?
No.
My name is Luke Burbank. I am your host.
Hello, everyone.
Coming to you from Portland, Oregon, the Rose City, a.k.a. Bridgetown, on a gorgeous Friday morning, here from the Hotel Jupiter, looking out on downtown Portland, and man, is it a sight. We got a great show in store for you. It's episode 3038 in a collector series, and I forgot my little, my brick and mortar bell. You know, the thing about Rick and Morty is every time I say brick and mortar now, I think of Rick and Morty, and I don't know if they did that on purpose, but, you know, I usually have a minimum of one actual physical desk bell I bring around, and of course, I forgot that, so I'm going all digital today, which means I have a complement of cool sound effects to play for you here on episode 3038 in a collector's series.
Let the fun begin.
Here's what we want to talk about. Elon Musk. Who knew that he was such a Trucktober and even Truckvember enthusiast?
The sale starts in Trucktober and extends to Truckvember.
He rolled something called the Cyber Truck out yesterday, and it is a sight to behold. He also decided to demonstrate the truck's super toughness by having a Tesla employee throw a metal ball at the supposedly shatterproof windows of the Cybertruck. And it didn't go great.
I wish I hadn't done that.
So we'll talk about that. We've got the tape from that event as well. And is it okay to respond to a text or email or Slack message with okay?
Okay.
Or is that cyberbullying someone to within an inch of their life? We will tackle okay versus KK and talk about that too. Coming up with this guy, the longest-running Cobra of the show, known for his drawings of tall ships. He is a soulful rocker from, you guessed it,
New Hampshire.
He is Andrew Walsh, and he's joining me right now from the Roosevelt neighborhood of Seattle, Washington. Hello, my friend.
Good morning, Luke. I want to come back to the Rick and Morty thing, because I did some research while you were talking, and I find the answer to the question you raised to be somewhat fascinating. But first, because I don't want, I've had a question on my mind I've been wanting to ask you for about 12 hours now, and I don't want it to get lost in the conversation. So if you don't mind, let me start with this. Yesterday, before Livewire, music is playing for the audience. One of our listeners has it on good authority that one of the songs that was playing before Livewire over the, you know, sound system yesterday was none other than William Joel's The Downeaster Alexa. Number one, can you confirm or deny this? Number two, if you can confirm it, can you explain it?
I can confirm it, Andrew,
mm-hmm.
that it was happening. I cannot explain it.
You really can't?
No, just one of those very bizarre coincidence things. So I was upstairs at the Alberta Rose Theater getting ready to do the show. kind of up in this, like, I don't know what you'd call it. Just, it's not the green room, because the green room is down to the side of the stage. That's where everybody hangs out and socializes. What I've learned over time of hosting that radio show is I don't want to socialize with anyone before the show starts, which I don't know if I've talked about this on air with you before, but it was kind of funny because when I got the job, I was, you know, I wanted everyone to like me, and I wanted to prove that I was just the perfect guy for this gig. And so I kind of just did everything they asked of me. It was not unlike a relationship. I was really putting my best foot forward for a while. And one of the things that was mentioned to me was that everybody liked that I was just out there socializing with everyone in the green room and all the guests and the sponsors, you know, because Courtney, when she was hosting, would kind of sequester herself away. And I remember thinking, oh, man, yeah, why wouldn't you want to just be in the green room, just getting the love and talking to people? And it took me about 3 months to realize I want to be nowhere near the green room before the show.
You just want to get your head right. I don't think that's rude. I mean, you're about to host a live show in front of an audience, like spending a few minutes or whatever just by yourself, getting your thoughts in order, I think is completely understandable.
Yeah, although really what it is, because we've already done our read through and my thoughts should be relatively in order at that point. What it actually is, I've learned, is socializing. And our listeners who are a little bit more on the shy side will be like, yeah, no S, Sherlock. But it's taken me this up till about this time in my life to realize that socializing actually takes energy away.
Oh, yeah. Who are you talking to?
Right, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Because I don't think – I've always thought of myself as a very outgoing person. And I kind of am, I think, although I think I'm getting less so in my old age, which is weird. And so what I've realized is that, like, if I'm a video game, character and my power is at 100 before the show starts, if I hang out in the green room, my power will be at 75 when I go on stage, and I would like my power to be at 100. So I'm upstairs. But the funny part is the room I hide out in is this weird place where they store props and such.
Yeah, I always picture you like a bat hanging upside down. It sounds like exactly, a kind of a belfry up there.
Yes, and depending on the week – and what else is going on at the Alberta Rose Theater? There's just all kinds of random shit up there. Just like, I don't know, like, oh, maybe they're doing, arsenic and old lace. And so it's just a bunch of like Victorian era furniture that someone has like spray painted a certain color because it's the steampunk version or whatever. Or there's some giant papier-mâché clock or who knows. I try to surround myself with papier-mâché clocks as much as possible,
yeah,
just as a sort of personal choice. It grounds me. Anyway, so I'm up in that weird room last night just kind of chilling out. But, of course, I'm also checking Twitter because even then I don't want to be alone with my thoughts. And I see a certain femme de mort, a certain TBTL and Livewire enthusiast who is tweeting that the Billy Joel song that a Downeaster Alexa or whatever is playing in the theater. And I was like, huh? And I went and I put my ear to the wall, and in fact it was playing, but I did not have anything to do with that. That's just one of those weird things.
Do you think that somebody is punking you, or is it really just a coincidence? No.
Total coincidence, because what I know is that walk-in music is probably picked by our sound engineer, D. Neil Blake. And I know that D. Neil Blake is not listening to TBTL. Uh-huh. He is not weaving in a super subtle joke to troll the four people in the Livewire audience who would get that reference.
Is your attitude towards the song changing the more that we talk about it? And now it's like maybe you had heard it before and just not paid attention, but now, of course, it stands out. Is your attitude towards this changing?
I will say this. When we had Hollywood power broker Wynn Rosenfeld on the show, and we played the song, I hated it less that time that I heard it. I think my knee-jerk sort of dislike for the song had to do with the mental journey I went on in the moment of hearing it in Hamilton, Missouri.
In a quilting store.
Which was, in a quilting shop, I hear a song, I'm thinking, is this... Like I said, I'm wondering, is this like a sort of contemporary Christian music? Like I was just, And then I Shazammed it, and then it was Billy Joel, and I already have kind of a little bit of an eye roll on some Billy Joel stuff. So it was sort of the perfect storm, not unlike what the Downeaster Alexa faces in the song, if you think about it.
Right, exactly.
It's really coming full circle.
Yeah.
So I think that it just caught me in a moment where I was like, gross, I hate this song. And then upon, you know, subsequent listenings, even right now as you're playing it, I don't hate the song. I'm hating the song less every time I hear it.
Yeah, I didn't mean to stop it, but I did. Yeah, it's funny. I don't think my attitude has really changed on it much, but it is funny how, number one, how friends can have influence over stuff like that, and then also how just kind of repetition can sort of build a certain kind of, I guess, connection. All right. Can I come back really quickly? I had never made the connection between Rick and Morty and brick and mortar. And I just, so I quickly Googled it and I found this, which I find to be a delightful post from somebody who seems to be at their wit's end on Reddit. The headline is, the show's name has to have been influenced by the term brick and mortar, right? This is in the Rick and Morty subreddit. Here's the message. I'm basically trying to settle a really fucking stupid argument with my roommate and friend. They've been freaking out, absolutely shocked, that I'm a firm believer that the name Rick and Morty came from the term brick and mortar. Maybe not the literal definition, but just the phrase itself. Am I totally an idiot for thinking so, or are my friends just a-holes? I don't know why I say the F word and then I clean up the A word. But anyway, here seems to be a definitive response from Kinyutaka on Reddit. It was influenced directly by the short document by the short Doc and Marty by the same creator. So apparently there was a short, I assume, by Justin Roiland. I don't know if Dan Harmon was involved in the original.
I know I'm checking. I'm currently checking my cell phone contacts to see if I have Dan Harmon's number.
Because see if
I have
we can just
had
call
occasion
him.
To interview him.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to text him, but I don't have it, so it will. We'll have to go with.
Yeah.
What are they called?
So
Tekashi 69.
Yes.
What's this person's name?
Kinyutaka. Anyway, so the doc, I keep on saying doc. No, the short, the like short version of this before it was a series, was called Doc and Marty, M-H-A-R-T-I.
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yes, because of like Back to the Future.
Yep, and that is based on Doc Brown and Marty McFly. Then, however, it is possible that subconsciously Justin chose Rick and Morty because they sound right together due to the association of Rick and Mortar or brick and mortar, but you are wrong that it came directly from that term. It's actually based on Doc and Marty. That was the original influence.
That makes total sense, too. In fact, it's funny because I didn't know that backstory, but I've been watching the new season of Rick and Morty is out. I just love that show so much.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I've now gotten – like honestly, this season is the most confusing to me of the kind of multiverse thing.
Yeah, they're going for
like,
it.
Like I don't – I honestly have no idea what's going on anymore. Like I feel like I was able to follow the first few seasons pretty well, and maybe they're just – getting a little, I wouldn't say bored, but the writers are just, to keep themselves interested, it's just becoming, like it's just, Rick just keeps emerging from a hole in the garage, and sometimes he's a crustacean, and it's like, because that's, but then everyone is Nazi crustaceans in that version, and then he's trying to stop that by, like, it's just
great.
So, it is so dense now, but I just love it. It just gives me, I don't know, I feel comforted when it is on my television, and but anyway, all of which is to say, of course, it's Doc and Marty. Even the kind of reedy voice that that Morty has, kind of you know, and like it's sort of a little Marty McFly, and you know, it's like, of course, that's Doc Brown and Marty.
You know, this is now reminding me, I think at some point somebody told me that there was originally this TV short called The Real Animated Adventures of Doc and Marty. I had totally forgotten about that. I'm on the IMDb page for it now. It does not seem like Dan Harmon was associated with it, unless I'm missing something major here. So it did just start with as a Justin project. So anyway, I find
I'm
that
having
all interesting.
A slightly, I appreciate your crack research team work on that. If I'm being maybe slightly more, I guess, quiet than normal, it's because I'm having an interesting experience podcasting from this room right now, Andrew, which is that one of our guests last night on the show was this lovely gentleman named James Kim, who has this really cool new podcast out called Moonface. Would recommend. And he also used to work on the Dinner Party Download, and he knows some mutual friends and colleagues of ours from the public radio world in Southern Cal. And he's produced a lot of different podcasts. And he and I were kind of last night before the show broing down on like just the podcast game. And he even remembered a time or two when you would come into KPCC in LA to do your end of TBTL. Mm-hmm. And so as it happened last night, as I was coming back to my hotel room, he and his partner are staying in the hotel room next to me.
I see.
And I'll just say this Jupiter Next hotel that I'm at, lovely hotel. And in fact, the view that I have right now is just, I almost can't describe it to you. It is so beautiful. I'm looking at just so many amazing things. That being said, the walls a little thin mm-hmm. in this hotel, and you can kind of hear what's going on in the room one over. But I took a picture of my rig here, you know, and sent it to him, texted him like, hey, I'm podcasting from the room next to you. And then he texted me, I'm going to turn up my TV really loud to mess with you.
So I hope he does. That way you'll feel.
I don't know if he's got a glass up against the yeah. wall, 1960s movie style or what, but it's like I feel like I'm doing the show for an audience of at least one other person in this hotel, and it's just making me probably a little bit more, I don't know, subdued than normal, because I'm trying to not just like holler and make it extremely easy to monitor what I'm talking about.
I did not notice that at all. Your energy seems fine. Although maybe at the, you know what, during the sound check, I noticed that you were talking a little bit lower than you normally would. So that makes sense. But yeah, you know, that's one thing, like in movies when they need to cover up the sound, like if they think the room is bugged, so then they turn on a radio loud and they talk like me. Is there a way you can do that without like ruining the fidelity of TBTL? Can you just like blast mm-hmm. some, I don't know, conservative talk radio or something?
I mean, I do that anyway.
Yeah.
And then I know you have to edit it all out, which is
filter.
Should I put more of that on?
Yeah,
right now?
Try that if you can. Yeah, try that.
Hey, are we still friends? Because I know that I haven't looked, uh-oh. But we're clashing on the fantasy field of fantasy football.
Oh, we are.
Week.
Yeah, right.
And I have to say, my friend, you are a gentleman and a scholar. You texted me yesterday afternoon and said, hey, just FYI, we're playing each other this week, and most of your players that you have currently going are on a bye week. So I think you said, I thought it would be the gentlemanly thing to do.
Yeah.
And even though I had somewhere in the back of my mind, oh, I should check in on my team, it's very possible it would have slipped my mind and I would have started a defense that's not playing, a kicker that's not mm-hmm. playing, and multiple players who are not playing. So I didn't do that, but I don't know how it's going. How, like, are you winning? Am I winning? And again, is this going to lead to hurt feelings like if I win, basically, if you tipped me off as to not like start a bunch of players that aren't playing and then I end up winning, are you going to be mad that you gave me a heads up?
No, although I did have a twinge of this. I wasn't watching the game last night, but I did at the last minute. One of my players was out, so I had to just like grab somebody off the wire and throw him in there. And I grabbed DeAndre Carter of the Houston Texans, a wide receiver who was playing last night. I was not paying attention, but at one point I opened up my app and I saw that we were well into the game and he was underperforming, to say the least, and you had like a 65% chance or 75% chance of beating me or something, and I did have a quick pang of, I wish I hadn't done that. Why not just beat the... Why not beat the Ghost Frigate Burbank Game of Throws? No, now it looks like he did pick up his game. He got a decent amount of points without going into too much detail. But now, according to the quick analytics from Yahoo Fantasy Sports, you have a 53% chance of winning.
Yeah,
I have a 47% chance. So it's close again.
This
and so I'm into
matchup.
It. Yeah, I would prefer to be close and fun. It would be a bummer if I had tipped you off and then you blew me out of the water just starting with
right.
Thursday night football.
Right. No, that would have been a bad outcome. But I appreciate your sportsmanship because, yeah, no, I'm actually excited about this. It's 53-47, which is effectively a coin toss. So it'll be a fun weekend, and it's much better than if I was already eliminated. Although I will say this about our fantasy league, I don't know if you know this, but basically up until someone plays, you can always swap them out. Whereas in the olden days, the bad old days of fantasy football that I remember, once the – and this is, I think, before Thursday Night Football was a thing. Once, like, the first game started, it was over. You couldn't change. It was locked. And I don't think that this particular, you know – This interface we use, Yahoo, I don't think it locks it. I think as long as the person hasn't played. So just in case you didn't know that, I was going to like let you know.
You know, I was kind of, you know, that question had been sort of at the back of my mind because recently I have been going in and doing some like, oh my gosh, it's literally like the system is very good at reminding you now too. Like you'll get some sort of a push notification on your phone. Like Thursday Night Football begins in a half hour and you have some holes in your lineup or something. You got somebody on a bye week. And so I rush and I do it. And then there was a time where I was moving things around. I'm like, wait, it looks like I could still move things around later. And just in the back of my head, I felt like that's not the way it's always been. Because I remember it used to be like deadline time. Like it was like a real, oh, shit, I got 30 seconds before kickoff. I got to get this lineup set. Who's on the wire? Somebody named Ronald McDonald. Sounds good. You're my new flex position.
Ronald McDonald for the Jacksonville Giants. Right. Is that even in the league?
sounds good for me. What's an XFL? I don't know. I'm exactly. Putting you in.
By the way, we need to go to a break and nobody cares, but I find the fantasy football scoring system to be so interesting because I have Aaron Rodgers as my kind of main quarterback. And then my backup is Mitch Trubisky from Chicago, who's been having just an awful season. And you would think, and Aaron Rodgers has turned in some pretty great games statistically. In fact, it's kind of why my team, which mostly was drafted by it was completely drafted by the computer, but then with limited modifications by me. The reason my team was doing well is because Aaron Rodgers has been having a killer season. Meanwhile, Aaron Rodgers is supposed to net me 25.71 points, and if I had started Mitch Trubisky, it'd be 20.41. That just doesn't seem like that big of a gap for one quarterback who I think of as being one of the best in the league and another quarterback who is so disappointing to Chicagoans that they're all ready to go jump in the Chicago River over it. Isn't that weird that it's only like a 5-point difference?
Yeah, well, after yesterday, I'm starting to really... not trust the Yahoo projected point predictions as much anymore because like I had a player like it's that part of the season where like, oh my God, last week I had a bunch of players on bye, so I just went to the wire and just took like whoever was kind of left, just kind of floating near the top. And I think I also grabbed a wide
Torque
receiver.
I
just grabbed some wide receiver from the Bengals whose name I've already forgotten and I've already thrown him back into the river. I grabbed him last week in an emergency and then I had him in yesterday and I was like, oh, this lineup's looking good. Wow, he's scheduled for 14 fantasy points. That's pretty good. Like, you know, for somebody who I just kind of grabbed for free and was going to keep for a week, maybe I should keep this fella. And then I just did a quick, but I'm like, that does not make sense. I'm reading about him and he's terrible. It's like, not only is he terrible, he gets
Was it Tyroy Smoochie Wallace?
He never gets targets. And so I was like, so I'm going elsewhere online and I'm like, yeah, no, this guy is going to be terrible. Like, I don't know why Yahoo says he's going to get 14, but in the words of Ronald McDonald, it's a trap. So I'm trying to like
famously.
Yeah. And so I'm really bad at knowing football players. Honestly, like even in the teams I follow, I will kind of forget sometimes, especially on defense, but whatever, like who's,
do you know who Miles Garrett is?
Is he playing anymore? I can't remember if he's in the league. His appeal was, by the way. Yeah. Finally, breaking news.
That.
His appeal was rejected. But anyway, I don't really know what's going on with
Mason,
the other players.
Did you see Mason Rudolph's look?
Are we doing this?
I mean, we shouldn't. We could, but should we? I think that what Miles Garrett did was really bad, and I think he should be in trouble for it. But I also think that Mason Rudolph played more of a significant role in this than a lot of people want to admit. He tried to pull Miles Garrett's helmet off. He just was less good at it. And I think his apology, or Mason Rudolph's sort of mea culpa, was it was some real BS thing that I just saw kind of floating across the sports wires, like something like I failed to live up to the standards or something. It was just like, bro, you got hot. You tried to pull Miles Garrett's helmet off. You said whatever you said. He took it too far. But, like, let's not act like this was just a complete – I mean, I don't know what you said on Friday to Phyllis about it. And my guess would be that as a Cleveland Brown fan, you want to be careful that you're not just seeming like you're, you know, completely blind to the violence that Miles Garrett, you know, committed out there. That helmet is a dangerous thing to be swinging. But I just – to me, Mason Rudolph – somebody pointed out, too, Mason Rudolph is 6'4". I think he's like 6'4 or 6'5, 250 pounds. Like, Mason Rudolph would be the biggest person we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, you know, like he's not, I don't know. I just, from the moment that I actually saw the clip of that thing that happened, I obviously Miles Garrett's going to be in trouble over that. But this idea, and I'm going to be totally honest with you, in my mind somewhere, race plays a role. This friggin' white dude, you know, kind of right out of central casting of whatever, Friday Night Lights, and then an African-American guy, and it's like, I just don't like the idea that the white guy's acting holier than thou.
Well, listen, we are way overdue for a break, but I do think this is a very, if we're just here anyway, I want to ask the question.
If we found ourselves in this verse, Luke and Andy multiverse.
I'm going to assume that the listeners are caught up with everything that we've talked about so far. But as far as the appeal is concerned, Miles Garrett, when he made his argument, and I guess he didn't make it in front of a panel. He makes it in front of one arbiter, basically. And he made the argument that not only was Rudolph going after him physically, as we saw on the tape, that's very clear. It's Rudolph who's getting in his face. He says that Mason Rudolph used the N-word.
Whoa, I didn't know that.
Or maybe it was an undefined racial epithet, but I'm pretty sure it's heavily implied that he said the N-word, which was something that people were circulating immediately afterwards. But you got to be careful with that. It was like a bunch of Browns, you know, fans, and apparently that's kind of an accusation that's made a lot.
That's some CrowdStrike, you know, possible.
Yeah,
sort
you're not on
unverified
the field. Conspiracy. Before anybody's been interviewed, you know, like there people are still on the field, yet some fans in Cleveland and Canton are claiming that the N-word was used. But now apparently Miles Garrett says that that is a fact, and Mason Rudolph has released two statements, one through his agent and one through the Steelers, saying that he absolutely denies that. I mean, this is a crazy question for you and I to ask. We could not be further from this, but I have to ask. No, I don't. But I'm going to ask, who do you believe?
Well, here's one little element, you know, in the fog of football war, who knows what goes on. But Marquise Pouncey, a player for the Ravens, who, by the way, used to
Steelers.
Run with Aaron Hernandez. Excuse me, Steelers. We had a trivia question about the Ravens last night on Livewire, so I've got Ravens on the brain. Marquise Pouncey, he is a black man, and he went after Miles Garrett. Now, if Mason Rudolph is yelling the N-word, would that impact if Marquise Pouncey is going to – like, if you're Pouncey, do you go, wait, whoa, huh? No? Like, I don't know. That's just something to throw in there as well. Like, somebody who was in the scrum there who would have presumably heard – racist stuff was still defending Rudolph. Maybe it's because, like, football, you know, Gatorade is thicker than water or blood or whatever. I don't know. Somewhere in there, there's something that makes sense. But you know what I mean? I don't know. It would be, let me put it this way. It would be surprising to me if Rudolph casually or even when he's triggered would throw around the N-word, because he mostly works with very large African-American men. And I feel like that's not going to – that's – because, I mean, Rudolph, I'm sure, gets mad during practice and during games. And if, like, that's kind of where your brain goes, it just seems like that's going to get you in a lot of trouble with a lot of people who happen to be black men that you're working with.
Yeah, and you know, I don't want to be, and I know I'm the one who raised this. Well, as I said, I had to raise it.
It was your solemn duty to this podcast.
Yeah, and there's very little details about it. Like, I've just read like two statements of him denying it, and nothing more than you know, like literally all I know is that this is supposedly a claim that Miles Garrett made behind closed doors in his appeal. But I don't want to be in a position where I'm telling an African-American man who says that he was the victim of a racially motivated act or, you know, whatever, that he's lying. Like, that's a very bad look. But what you say also, I just don't know what it's like in the modern day NFL, if those words are just thrown around, I guess because of the reasons you say, I'd be surprised. Now, I'm not saying that there's no racism in the NFL. I think there's a lot of racism in the NFL. I'm sure it pops up in ways that we would maybe even find shocking if we were more boots on the ground there, cleats on the ground. But like you say, like I don't know if Rudolph had some sort of reputation for always kind of being on the edge on things like this, or he had a reputation for treating people of color unfairly or anything like that. Well, then I think I would be more open to it. I guess it really pains me, though, if I do believe that Miles Garrett is just telling a bold-faced lie. That would really pain me because, again, I've been arguing and I truly believed that Miles Garrett, despite – I mean, I know the nation now knows him because of this one outlying act of aggression. That has never been his reputation. His reputation is being a very centered, hardworking young man who's like deserves a lot of respect. I mean, again, I'm not saying that people should feel that way about him now, but like, trust me, that was his reputation.
Yeah, he's into poetry. I mean, like all the stories about Miles Garrett were that he's this, you know, really thoughtful kind of interesting guy who has a lot more than just football going for him. The other thing that I would say about that is this shouldn't matter, but the initial hit that happened in my mind wasn't even that bad. Basically, Miles Garrett tries to tackle Rudolph. I guess maybe you could say the game was over. Like, why would you try to tackle him? But Garrett falls to the ground and pulls Rudolph down onto him. Like, it is not even like one of those hits where it's like the defensive back just lands full body weight on the quarterback and like separates their clavicle or whatever. It's like the actual hit was like Rudolph landed on top of Miles Garrett. And I don't know why that matters to me, but it's just like, it feels to me like the original moment wasn't even like, it wasn't even that big of a deal in my mind. Again, I'm not Mason Rudolph. I'm not out there. I don't know what it's like to be tackled or even to be pulled down atop Miles Garrett. But I don't know. That whole thing is just really weird to me. And I hope – yeah, I – do you ever – have you done this thing where you like lie in bed and you just think, what if he just doesn't swing the helmet?
I mean, it was just a trap. I mean, in the moment, I was just thinking, like, we had 8 seconds left. Like, the world would be – like, I felt it as it was happening. Just like, what? Wow. Like, this is such – I mean, like, again, I went into this with last week with Phyllis. But, like, what is lost to, again, the casual listener or follower of these things is this is such a huge win for the Browns to beat the Steelers, who've been their like number one rival, you know, with the Ravens being a very close number two, but for literally generations now, and a team that has beaten us every single matchup for five goddamn years to finally end that streak in a year when we could maybe pull things together and not be the Browns of the past. Like, what is more Brownsy than suddenly just they always find new ways to completely destroy you? Like, I've been saying that for years now. Sometimes that's just in game. They find new creative ways to lose. They clean up everything else, and then something else goes haywire and whatever. But then even this is like, wow, they even got the win, but they're making me absolutely miserable.
It was unreal because it was like I was listening while I was driving in Virginia, and I was like, oh, there's 8 seconds left. And I thought, well, they can't lose this game. Like, I remember having the thought, okay, there's not – it's statistically impossible for them to lose. So I was like, that's amazing. They did it. And then what unfolded in front of my ears was like a fever dream. Like, wait, what? This is what's happening? Like, like, if you sat down and you wrote out what are the things that could happen in the last 8 seconds of a football game that would be unprecedented and would be, like, snatching – a sort of, a, in a way, a kind of PR defeat from the jaws of victory. I mean, this is pretty, other than, I don't know, I honestly can't even think of other examples. It was so wild. Again, I'm not, I know that this is a big emotional thing for you because you have followed this team for a while and you're, you know, so I'm not trying to make light of it, but I was just, I couldn't believe what I was hearing because I was like, you couldn't have even made this up.
I know. All right. Well, I'm sorry. I got to be. Right. We're way overdue for break, I worry about kind of isolating the people who really don't care about this stuff. Although I will say to the person who tweeted at me, "What? No point conversion this week? I guess you got it.
It's just
a little delayed." And then the last thing I will ask before we go to break is there any chance you could knock on the wall and ask our friend James Kim if he thinks Mason Rudolph said the N-word, or could you just do that during the break?
I'll text it with no explanation. I don't know if he likes football. I'll just be like, yo, James.
Mason Rudolph,
N-word, question mark, guy shrugging emoji.
Let's
take a quick break, and then we'll be back with his response in a moment.
Dad, why did you let that man push you around like that? You should have beat him down, down to the ground, down to the ground for that. He said, son, you're still
young.
This is
seriously taking some of our listeners back. Little Pedro the Lion.
Yeah, I never got into Pedro the Lion. I know them. I think that I first heard their name spoken on TBTL when I was a listener years and years and years ago. And every time you play a song by them, I say, you know what? This is the week. I'm going to go on my Pedro the Lion deep dive. And I always forget somehow.
I don't know. You know, it was such a, for me, it was a real moment in my, I guess, college years, particularly with this album, but also because, like, the guy Dave Bazan, who's the main guy behind the band, is an old friend of mine. We were in church youth group together. So it's all kind of like, you know, I don't know if listening to it in 2019, you know, I don't know what the if you'll vibe with it or not. But man, this album in particular, is this, I think it's Hard to Find a Friend. Does it tell you what the name of the album that this is?
Yeah, that
is
the album. And it's from 98, man. I always thought of them as like kind of an early 2000s, which I know that's a, you know, 98 is almost early 2000s. But somehow like seeing 98 there, man, I'm a little behind on my listening.
I listened to this record on repeat. I entered a novel writing contest that when I was, this is would have been at the end of my college days. I probably told this story a bunch of times. But I remember it was a publisher in Canada called, I think, Anchor Books. And it was a Labor Day weekend novel writing contest. So the rules were you had to write a novel. You had, whatever, 3 days, right? Labor Day weekend to write the novel and submit it. And I think it was like $100 to enter or something. And I was in my apartment on Capitol Hill. And I was trying to write my great 3-day novel. And for some reason decided to smoke a pipe, which made me feel very sick. I know.
That's the most Burbank thing I've ever heard in my life. Okay, I'm going to start this project. Where are my props? What can I buy?
You're so right. Oh, my God. I never even really thought of it, but you're exactly right. And I just remember listening to this album over and over and over again. You know, it was this CD at the time. And sitting there and, like, writing and writing and writing and writing. And, like, I mean, I spent, like, I mean, the actual premise for the story I don't think was terrible, which was, I'm sure I've told you about this either on or off air, but the idea was on the day Frank Sinatra dies, there's a different guy who has a very similar name, and he's famous because he's like a corporate raider. He's just like a kind of bad financial dude, I think his name is Frank Sinclair, and they publish his obit accidentally. Instead of Frank Sinatra's. And something like that actually happened. I forget the specifics, but when I was working in college in the news, there was some day where like the wrong obit went out because it was like the person's last name was one off from the person who actually died. And it got me thinking about that. So it was kind of like a reverse It's a Wonderful Life. It's like this guy's – everybody thinks this guy's dead. This is one of those many things that only works before cell phones. You know? Like, so this dude is basically, you know, everybody thinks he's dead and nobody cares. And he kind of has this realization of how terrible he's
that's
been
not
in the
bad.
World.
I don't think you've told me that. If so,
is that the worst idea for
– not at all.
Worst idea,
that's
right?
Really interesting because nobody can – you say no cell phone so nobody can track him down basically. Like people aren't as easily reached. Is that what you mean by
that?
Yeah.
What, I mean like the New York Times publishes – again, I don't know if this was actually the name I came up with. The New York Times publishes Frank Sinclair's – actually, maybe it was the Associated Press and it goes out to all the – again, this is also a different media era, you know.
Yeah.
But this – because the AP has a lot of pre-written obits for people.
Yeah.
So it goes out. Frank Sinclair's obit goes out and everybody thinks he's dead. And he's having a hard time proving that he's not dead, and also no one's sad that he's dead, and it's kind of this realization for him. But it happens on the day Frank Sinatra dies.
I see.
So whatever. Point is, this book that I was writing while smoking a pipe and listening to Page of the Lion, there's probably, I don't know, the thing is probably 100 pages. 60 of it is just this diner that his mom worked at in North Carolina. Like I had no sense of like... You know, like I just was writing about okra or something for pages.
You're just going into too much detail, in other words.
Way too much detail about a thing that's not even like really that relevant. Like it was just – it's like a 100-page book about a guy that this happens to, and 60% of it is about a diner his mom worked at in North Carolina that's not essential to the plot.
Did
you want to know
– did you finish it?
Why I didn't win the contest.
So you did finish it, like not just the outline of the story.
No, I finished it and I sent it in. I mean, I think the ending was terrible. I think he's like walking on like a street in New York and there's like a small like a kind of Latino like Catholic chapel and he goes in it. I mean, it's – I'd smoked a lot of tobacco that weekend.
Yeah,
my brain was a little addled. If I could dig it out somewhere, I'm sure I would – you know what? It probably lives on a like – early Apple laptop that I bought at the University of Washington bookstore because you got a discount if you were a student. Like on, I don't even know what it was called, but it was, you know, like one of the very first laptops that Apple made. There's somewhere in a landfill in China is this laptop with this story sitting on it. And I have to tell you, I cannot stand by the content of that story.
Yeah, but I'm
the
glad
premise
you went
not
for
being
it,
the
though.
Worst.
I used to love writing in college. And like now, you know, I've told you I did it just all the time on my own. Like I didn't have a computer to play Hearthstone on or whatever. So I would just like I did have a junky old computer, as I've said many times, that, you know, was not connected to the internet. And it was just 486 and I would just type. And I thought I was like a little Bukowski or something, because every drunk white college student thinks he's a Bukowski. But I liked the act of it. I also took some classes where, you know, forced us to write. I remember I wrote a short story called, I think it was just called Bridget, or certainly the main character is named Bridget. Although I'm sure that it probably doesn't even pass the Bechdel test, because I think Bridget was like, I think it might have been written from the perspective of a guy pining after her. I mean, that sounds like me. I don't even know. I remember my point is really loving the process. Also, I'm just so embarrassed about how I acted. I acted like I was a writer, which is really embarrassing. I actually reached out to that
Did
professor.
You smoke a lot of pipes while you were doing
it? I did have a pipe, but I don't think – yeah. But anyway, I remember I bought a corn cob pipe one time because I was like, I want to try smoking tobacco in this. It was awful. It was because it was a really cheap-ass pipe, and I was like smoking the sides of the pipe. I think it was so gross. But whatever. As a young man, I was feeling things out, but I was also like this young, white, probably guy who thought like – it is funny. Like I've never been a guy with a lot of confidence, and maybe I'm exaggerating it in the rearview mirror here, but I look back at this time. Like I think that – basically what it was I was in a small class, this one specific writing class I'm talking about. It was a very informal class. It was like kind of a writing class like you would see in a movie, right? Like we were on a first name basis with the professor. I think we often sat in a circle. We were all like writing. It was like very – it was a lot of creative writing and then sharing your work and talking about it. And everybody else really was terrible. And like that's a bad thing to say, but I was better – at writing than most of the people in the room, but it doesn't mean that as a good writer. And I'm just like, I know that I have that short story, Bridget, somewhere that I was so proud of, and my teacher gave me, you know, good feedback on, and it was a long process, but I really hope I never accidentally, like, read it. I hope I'm never, like,
publish it as the newsletter.
Yeah, I hope I'm never, like, accidentally, like, just into my cups enough to come across it on an old hard drive and open it up, because I know, like, I'm actually, no joke, I'm getting a physiological reaction to even thinking about that right now, kind of, like, nervous, like, I'm like, I bet you it's just so bad. And
I bet you it's not so bad. Yeah. I bet you it's I mean, I it's probably something that, you know, it's different than you would right now just because you've had more life experience, but I bet you it's not terrible. I can't remember what it was, but I found some old, when I don't know what I was doing, but somehow I found an old, like, oh, I know what it was. It was for a drama class. I had to write, like, it was something where we had to basically, like, restage an existing play. Like, we had to basically say, like, we're going to do this play, whatever it was. For me, it was like Oedipus Rex, but here's what I'm going to do with it that's going to make it different. And I remember writing this, like, it was this, like, the final paper for this class, and of course I waited until the day before, so I just spent 24 hours working on this. And I remember actually, like, walking the printed out, and it was huge, the final document, and, like, leaving it outside the door of the professor's office. You know that whole move?
I don't know if I ever did that, but definitely the physicality of it back then. I don't know. I wonder if you're in a class like that today. Do you even ever print out your final manuscript? Because to me, that's a huge part of it, is having this physical thing that you say, like, I birthed this.
Absolutely. I think it's – yeah, no. And also, like, there was so much – because it was Rick and Morty back then, you know, there were so many more ways that you could kind of – fudge with it. Like, you could mess with the margins, you could mess with spacing, you could say the building was locked, you could be like, I tried to drop it off, but now you just submit it digitally and they know, like, when you did it. There's nothing stopping you. Like, a lot of the excuses that I used in my college days have been eliminated by technology now. But I found this, I got an A on this thing, and I found it somewhere, and, like, again, it was not gonna win any BAFTA awards, but it was not as terrible as I would have thought it was, if that makes any sense. Like, it was fairly juvenile. It was very obvious. Like, you know, as the play goes on, these things on stage would be collapsing because what we realize is Oedipus's life is a facade. I mean, it's, you know, like, it was not the most insightful thing, but I was reading it and I was like, this isn't, like, I'm not. I don't want to curl up in a ball and die over this. And I bet you that the story that you wrote, I bet you it's better than you think it is.
I bet you the writing is fine, but I'll bet you it's just so embarrassing. I bet you it's about a young man who's drinking too much and is pining after some perfect ingenue. And perfect being, like, the mid-90s platonic ideal of, like, some probably...
Truth About Cats and Dogs.
Yeah, I was
going to
say Daria-esque character, I'm sure.
La la la, la.
Oh God! Somebody kill me.
But we can't do that yet, Andrew, because we have got to thank the donors of the day.
You want me to play the music from over here?
Yeah, would you mind? I would just not. Play the Daria theme song.
Wait. You know what?
No, I'm kidding. Oh, no, you're gonna
do it? No, like, wait. It's too short, though, right? Isn't it like 5 seconds long? Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Let
exactly.
me just go back to her.
Yeah, this is more upbeat. Not only do these people not want you to die unceremoniously, Andrew, they want us to continue doing the show for years to come. Why? How do we know that? Because they're donating to the program, and they're making it all possible. We're talking about Brian Maddox of Silverton, Oregon, and also Kelly Blower of Whitehall, Michigan. And then, of course, no donors of the day list would be complete without Tim Petruk from Kamloops, British Columbia. I was writing a made-up story for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me last week or 2 weeks ago, and I wanted it to involve a Western Hockey League team, and I was going to go with Kamloops, but I was like, people will think I made up the place Kamloops, and it will distract everybody from the other hilarious jokes that I'm writing into this piece.
See, you're still a writer. You're still flexing those muscles. By the way, speaking of loops, really quickly, this is inappropriate to bring up now. Sorry, donors. Let's give Andy some time here. I was going through an old folder of TBTL music that I had from way back, I think before I was even on the show, but when I was mixing the weekend replays for you guys at Cairo back in 2011 or whatever, and one of the songs was Land of Loops, and I was like, that's right, that was something Land of the Loops, that was something that looped large, that loomed large in TBTL, but I don't know why. Was it your original outro music or something?
No, I just loved Land of the Loops. It was one of those... It was one of the first bands that I had heard that used... It's funny because it is kind of TBTL-ish because it's like they would... In fact, oh my gosh, this is so funny. There is a particular Land of the Loops song that starts with... You want to talk about inappropriate for thanking the donors of the day. There's a Land of the Loops song that starts with a woman saying, like, no shit, daddy. And I never knew what that was. And then I was recently watching... some trailers for, you know, that new Eddie Murphy movie where he's playing Rudy Ray Moore, aka Dolomite?
No, I don't know about this.
So Rudy Ray Moore was this really interesting kind of self-made, he created this film character, this kind of blaxploitation character named Dolomite. And I had kind of heard the name Dolomite, but I didn't know a lot about it. Well, Eddie Murphy's in this new movie where he plays the guy. And so it led me down this rabbit hole of watching all these trailers for actual Dolomite films, which would recommend. But in one of them is the woman saying, no shit, daddy.
Right.
And like, I have been hearing that in a Land of the Loops song for 20 years of my life and never knew what the origin was. And it was one of those moments where I was like, oh, wow, that's where it's from. So I loved Land of the Loops because it kind of involved drops, basically.
And you also, I mean, the song that, I don't know if this will ring a bell to you, but the song that I have here that I think you would ask me, maybe this is how we closed out the radio version or something, was a song called Goodbye, where it gets really flangey here. Let me just, you know what? Jeez, yeah. Louise. Let's thank these.
Land of the Loops, flangey donors of the day.
This taking you back?
Yeah, of course. And then there's just like little weird, like... talking part that comes up in a second. Yeah. It says, like, no one can ever really know what anyone else is doing or something.
Is there a chance that I cut that out so that I could use this as bed music?
Maybe.
Because this is just off of my... Yeah, you notice this is actually listed as an edit, which means I definitely looped this Land of the Loops, so I bet you I took off...
The hotel is calling me, telling me I need to leave the room.
Is this true? We better thank the donors of the day.
I'm going to call them. I'm going to call them and say, can I stay for... Well, I have 10 more minutes anyway, I think. Can we wrap the whole show up in 10 minutes? Can I tell you about...
Can we wrap
Cybertruck?
Up the Hold on, I'm gonna... donors in 10 minutes is a better question.
I'm going to literally, on the air, while we're playing Land of the Loops, call the front desk of the hotel and ask them if it's okay if I stay for another minute.
Things got really weird on TBTL today.
Yeah. Hey there, this is Luke Burbank up in 603. Is there any chance I can get a 12 o'clock checkout? Okay. Thank you so much. Handled, my friend.
Nice.
Yeah.
This is getting trippy.
Are we leaving any of this in?
I'm leaving it all in. This is a weird moment. I'm
really?
Sorry. We also talked about Miles Garrett for about a half hour before we got to the break. So
did that happen or did I hallucinate?
We're breaking all the rules.
Okay. But you know who loves it? Charles Phipps of Columbia, South Carolina.
That's what I hear.
Another donor of the day. And then what about Riley Gifford in Tacoma, Washington? Riley's like, yeah. More Land of the Loops and more Luke calling the front desk of the hotel.
That's
please,
right.
I'm here for it. Put it in my veins. Molly Jameson doesn't like me saying put it in my veins, and yet she still donates to the show. She's in Tallahassee, Florida. Molly, thank you very much. Also Riley, Charles, Tim, Kelly, and Brian. Thanks for making this show weird as it is on this Friday. Thanks for making the show possible.
Hello and welcome to Top Story.
All right, I'll try to be. Why don't we hold the Katie Weaver? Is it okay to say okay? Thing
yeah.
For Monday, because that's
yeah.
a great you found that and sent it to me, and I think that's a great topic. There's just so much in even the even the email that the person sends to Katie Weaver, there's much to unpack. So we'll talk about that on Monday. But let's talk about this Cybertruck thing. So I didn't know this was in the offing. I guess people that are real Tesla heads were eagerly anticipating this rollout because Elon Musk had been talking in the past, I don't know, year about the fact that they were developing a truck. And yesterday was the rollout. And are you looking at a picture of this thing yet, Andrew?
Oh, let me do this now. I was holding off because I wanted to do it actually on the show.
Yeah.
Because I'm unfamiliar with this story.
Okay, let's put on Land of the Loops.
Yeah.
You look at the Cybertruck. I got to check back in with the front
desk. Look at okay, look at this thing. Yeah, it looks like something out of like an 80s movie, right? Like The Road Warrior or something.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's hard to describe. To me, it feels like something that was made in Minecraft.
Yeah, like, yeah, that's I could see that.
The lines, it has no round lines on it. It's very angular. And when you say truck, you know, we think of a truck as being something that has like a bed in the back of it. That's what makes it a truck and not a car. Well, this thing has that. It's just covered by some kind of, you know, fancy rolling hardened cyber steel. But you can basically like press a button and the back of this vehicle, this cover rolls out and then you have a bed. It sort of feels like if there was an El Camino on Fury Road.
Yeah. It is more futuristic now that I'm looking at more. I guess it's a little more – it's almost like if the Road Warrior happened on the moon is kind of what it looks like.
Yes, and in fact, I believe Elon Musk has said that this – I don't know if he was joking or not, but something to the effect of like – when SpaceX goes to Mars, this is going to be the Mars rover that they use, and it looks like it could be some kind of a Mars rover type of thing. Like it's I mean, I have to give them credit; it is extremely outside the norm for what a truck looks like, which is actually kind of cool to me, I guess. The funny part, though, to me was first of all, this is the cult of Elon Musk and the kinds of guys who, and it's mostly guys who just become tumescent over this stuff is just interesting to me. He drives this, maybe because I just watched that that kind of quasi documentary about John DeLorean starring Alec Baldwin that was really good. I would highly recommend. It's a kind of it involves actual archival footage, but then also Alec Baldwin, reenacting John DeLorean things. But there's a lot of similarity here. Elon Musk is driving this weirdo truck up onto this stage, and it's just a sea of dudes with their cell phones aloft videoing it and freaking the hell out. It's basically like it's like a I don't know. I don't want to generalize, but let's just say it's a kind of guy that is not – I don't probably have a lot in common with because I don't do kettlebells, and I don't think that incels kind of make a point, and I don't – whatever else weird stuff these borderline Joe Rogan fans are up to is not really my vibe. Okay, that being said, he drives this truck onto the stage. Everyone's freaking out. He gets out. He stands in front of it. And then he's talking about how it's made out of some kind of crazy metal that you cannot dent or scratch. And he has one of the designers or developers come out with a sledgehammer and whack the side of this truck. And it amazingly is not dented. So I mean, I guess it's like, you know, don't worry about pissing someone off in the Walmart parking lot because they can't harm your space truck. But the thing is, it also supposedly has these he says it's bulletproof, by the way, too. And they didn't fire a gun at it, but he did say the windows are smash proof. And so he has the guy pick up a metal ball and try to throw the ball at the window and try to smash it. And I'm just going to play this for you, Andrew. This is – it's a little – maybe a little hard to follow just the audio, but let's just say it didn't go great.
Try to break this glass, please.
So the guy is going to go get this metal ball.
Yeah. Sure? Yeah.
Now this – okay, I was watching this last night, Andrew, and you can kind of hear the guy who's – obviously knows what's going on, the guy that works with Elon Musk. He goes, "You sure?" Well – they friggin' talked about this backstage.
Right.
It isn't like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm like, okay, I feel like I'm watching Penn and Teller or something. Yeah. Like, they're pretending like this is like, oh, is that a bad idea? But it's like, of course, they know that it's going to be fine because they've done this before. Like, you would never just be improvising this on stage in front of the eyes of the world. Anyway.
Oh, my fucking God. Well, maybe that was a little too hard.
So the guy throws the metal ball at the window, and it just completely
It just goes right
it.
Through.
That is Elon Musk saying, oh, my fucking God.
Oh, my God.
On stage at the
That's
rollout.
That's like when Bill Gates got the blue computer screen of death during a national presentation. That's awful.
I mean, so you can tell that, like, the guy who threw the ball is like, what do we do? And you can tell, I mean, I'm going to give Elon Musk some credit here. He sort of rolls with it. He goes, well, it didn't completely break it.
Yeah.
Like, it shattered the glass, but it didn't actually go all the way through. But then the guy is trying to kind of make it better, so he wants to throw the ball at the back window.
Oh.
To, like, to try to be like, well, maybe we can get it to bounce off of one of these windows.
Oh,
so
no.
He looks at Elon and he's like, do you want me to throw it at the back window? And Elon's like, okay. And
should we try it on the door?
Sorry? Okay. It didn't go through. That's a plus side.
Let's try the right.
So he throws it at the back window now.
Sure.
Completely shatters it.
Man. Oh, again? Really? I wasn't ready for that.
Both
I'm not even
windows.
Joking. I thought for sure.
Both windows are shattered.
Oh, my God. Like, that's embarrassing.
There are all these photos now of Elon Musk standing triumphantly on the stage in front of his Cybertruck with just two fucking shattered windows behind it.
Oh, man. I don't know exactly what optics are, but I think these are bad ones.
I mean, again, I think what Elon – I don't have it on this piece of tape, but I think what he went on to say was like, well, there's always room for improvement or something.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, I will have to give this guy credit. Elon Musk has done – I mean, he has done a lot of stuff in his life and a lot of stuff that's pretty remarkable. I mean, those rockets landing backwards, I mean, I'm mm-hmm. never going to get over seeing
that.
Like,
I remember
SpaceX
that, yeah.
Stuff.
Yeah.
Like, and even Tesla, you know, boy, being in the Bay Area and out in the, like, kind of East Bay where there's a lot of money. And there were times when I was on the road going out to Alanis Morissette's house that I was behind a Tesla, which was passing a Tesla coming the other direction, which had a Tesla behind it.
Yeah.
You think
towing
I'm joking.
Towing a Tesla
yes.
on a Tesla yeah. boat. Yeah.
Ooh, Tesla boat. I could get into that.
Yeah, I bet you could.
That would never break. Tesla boat will never let me down. But no, like, I got to give Elon Musk a certain amount of credit. I mean, he has really been, you know, in charge of creating some things that are pretty amazing. And the story of this truck, it may end up being kind of a hit or whatever. I'm sure that I don't think it's going to be defined by these two windows. But man, that was a bad plan. Like, did they not? Like, what happened with that?
Yeah.
Like,
how many times did they try it?
Yeah, and were they using a different ball, or was this a different window, or did they not, like, did he throw it too hard? Like, I just, man, I feel kind of terrible for the other guy, because you know, I mean, he just, like, because Elon said maybe you threw it too hard. It was like, I would be so cringing if I was the other dude. But the other thing that I thought was kind of interesting is, so this truck is going to sell. The base model of it's going to sell for like $40,000, which is kind of like what a big truck costs these days,
mm-hmm.
Which is amazing. Although, as the various articles mention, kind of drolly, and we actually said this about the Mustang. That's how we started the week talking about an electric Mustang. Basically, a lot of articles are like, yeah, the people who want a Tesla and the people who want a big burly truck, not really the same group. And Elon Musk has even said basically he's personally obsessed with trucks and he doesn't really care if this is a big mm-hmm. seller or not, which I don't understand the economics of that. Seems like it must have been expensive to develop. So if you don't sell a bunch of them, maybe that's lost money. But
I'm not a big Tesla fan, or I'm definitely – I should say a Musk fan. I'm definitely not an Elon Musk fan. But I will say that I don't think that this is the future. I don't think that people are going to be driving the Cybertruck all over the place. But mm-hmm. I do think big, showy technological advances like this set the stage for more practical things that come later, potentially by other creators. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, like, that's, yeah.
And that's kind of what this is probably leading to.
Yeah. One of the articles that I read about this, there's actually a number of different electric truck companies that are, you know, will be producing electric trucks soon. And, you know, there's a practical side to it. I mean, we need pickup trucks in this country to haul things around. So if those could be electric, that would be pretty cool. So, yeah, I know what you mean. Like, sometimes you got to do a big showy thing and bash the windows in order to, like, create the marketplace for, like, more realistic things to come down the line later.
Yeah. And I mean, I have an idea. I'm sure that there will be more presentations and demonstrations. Here's what I suggest. If he does this again next year or something, what they do is, instead of throwing a metal ball, they get Miles Garrett to come out there with his helmet and just
hit
the window and show that it does not shatter.
That would be, you have Mason Rudolph and Miles Garrett each holding a helmet. And they just go to friggin' town on this truck.
All right, I know you know about TBTL, the podcast. You're listening to it right now. But have you tried TBTL, the newsletter? Because you can. Just go over to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. I gotta say, it's a lot of fun. Every week, Luke and I record a little video that we include in the newsletter. It's called Hey Dummies. We answer your questions, any questions you want to ask us. Well, there's all kinds of things in the newsletter. Don't take my word for it. Here, this is Mary. She's a big fan of the newsletter.
It has a nice welcome introduction, but then you have these phenomenal GIFs that are so much fun. You talk about amazing, wonderful people, and you introduce us to new things. And then the songs of the week. Oh, my gosh. And it just makes me so happy.
It can make you happy, too. I mean, listen, this is coming from Mary. She doesn't even listen to the podcast. She's here just for the newsletter. No joke. So, again, go to tbtl.net and click on the button that says sign me up for the TBTL newsletter. And we'll try to bring a little extra sunshine to your inbox every Friday afternoon.
All right, let's do a little music for your weekend before we get out of here. Andrew, I know you're excited about your song. Yeah. I'll mention to the listeners, I'm more excited about my song.
No, I am more excited about my song. Why are you? We were talking before the show. I said, I'm really excited about my song. So am I. And then you like out-excited me. And so, of course, everything's a competition with me. Let me make this really brief, and I'll just play it. I don't have a huge backstory on this song. I got a promotional email from someone that was highlighting this new collection of singles by a band called Varsity that I had never heard of before. Apparently, they're a Chicago band, been around since I think 2013, and this is called The Basement Takes. It's a collection of singles from them between 2015 and 2017. The name of this song is Cult of Personality, and from what I can tell, this has been kind of their biggest single through the years. Why?
Well, because that's a isn't that also a Living Color song?
Oh, yeah. God, I forgot about that.
But this
that.
Isn't the cover of that song.
No, very different. Very different. So, okay, take a listen to this. This is A Cult of Personality by Varsity. Shocked that the song would appeal to me.
I like that a lot, though.
It's good. So, yeah, check it out. There's a brand new collection called The Basement Takes, 2015 through 2017, I think it's called.
The song that I want to suggest is a song called UFO by this guy, Jim Sullivan, who I mentioned last week. There was an article, Rebecca Bengel wrote about it in the New York Times, about this dude, Jim Sullivan, who basically disappeared in the 1970s in a town called Santa Rosa, New Mexico. He was kind of this guy kind of kicking around L.A., trying to make it as a singer, and never really came together for him. But there were, she was in the article citing a lot of artists who I like who say that they really like this album UFO. So I downloaded it and I started listening to it when I was in San Francisco last week and driving around and driving across like the Bay Bridge and stuff. And it is like such perfect music, I think, for driving around. It, you feel like you're inside a less depressing version of Midnight Cowboy or something. Like, it's just, and the whole album from front to back, I just can't recommend it highly enough. But this is maybe the catchiest song off of the album. It's called UFO. So are you able to play that from there, Andrew?
Yep, I got it right here. Here it is.
Okay, take a listen to this. This is Jim Sullivan.
Shaking like a leaf on the desert heat. His daddy's got a bang that's so hard to beat. I bought me a ticket, got a front row seat. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye. Looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO? Chicks are full in the book I read. Only man I know that got up from the dead. A lot of people living by the words that I said. I'm checking out the show with a glassy eye. Looking at the sun dancing through the sky. Did he come by UFO?
What do you think? I like this. This is really up my alley.
Yeah, dude, this whole album, and not every song is this kind of, I guess you could say, poppy. Like, some of them are a bit slower, but it just works as an album from the very, like, first song till the very end, which is also rare in this day and age. Mm-hmm. And I put on an album and I just listen to it all the way through. But not to get all, like, I don't know, mystical with it, but one of the things that's so interesting is he has a song on the album where he's singing about a guy's funeral and how the guy looked so natural. And his hair was perfect lying in the casket. And this guy, Jim Sullivan's point is he doesn't want to die that way. He's like, I just want to be turned into dust and I just want to be put out in the wilderness. Mm. Well, he disappeared and no one's ever found him. This is reading from this New York Times piece. On his 1969 debut album, he sang of beckoning highways, of aliens, of an Arizona ghost town, of a man who looked so natural in death. It was clearly his time to go. 6 years later, the 35-year-old Sullivan disappeared in Santa Rosa, New Mexico. On the front seat of his recovered gray V-dub Bug were his ID, his beloved 12-string Guild guitar, and a box of his two albums, UFO and the 1972 LP, Jim Sullivan. He basically was driving from L.A. to Nashville. He was married with a kid, but he was going to go out to Nashville to try to, like, get his music career really going, and he never made it past New Mexico, and they've never found him.
Wow.
I haven't listened to the LP. What I read about it was that it was a little more produced and a little bit, I don't know, just didn't have this exact vibe from this that this album UFO has. Mm-hmm. But man, oh man, if you're driving somewhere, Andrew, in the next few weeks, if you have a road trip or just whatever, I really recommend putting this album on and just listening to it all the way through. It's so good.
Yeah, I will. My one problem, one thing I'm running into with Music for Your Week, and I love it when we have, like, and this has happened quite a bit, where either your song or the listener's song is so good that then I listen to that the following week, but then I don't have anything new to bring to the table for my own. Like, so many times I want the music for my weekend to be whatever you or a listener chose for music for your weekend the week before, just so I can say, I've been listening to it and it's really good. Let's listen to it again.
You can just pick a different Jim Sullivan song for next week.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of really good ones on that album, UFO. I ain't mad at that.
Oh, hey, by the way, only because you were out, can I just offer you this? Okay. The last week's listener submission from listener Brooks was a song called Jackpot by Nikki Lane. And Brooks describes Nikki Lane as a modern-day Loretta Lynn. I loved this song so much, and knowing that you have more of an affection towards that kind, that era of country, you should check that out. Write that down, Nikki Lane, Nikki with two K's. Okay. Listen to it on the plane and let me know what you think.
Okay. That's my assignment, your assignment. Listen to Jim Sullivan, okay. UFO.
Will do.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Our listener suggestion comes from Mark in Minnesota. Mark says, I may have totally missed the boat on this song, and maybe it's being played all over and everyone is already sick of it, but I just learned of it. I Spotify almost exclusively and try to fold in new music to stay soups hip, but I heard this on commercial radio, which makes me think I'm late to the party. This is just a banger. And the singer's voice and pronunciation, accent, he puts in parentheses, are strangely, he wrote memorizing, but I believe that Mark meant mesmerizing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I can't speak for Mark, so get at me. Maybe you meant memorizing, Mark. Anyway, so this song actually, what you have the file there.
Yeah,
what
I'm going to play it off of iTunes instead of the YouTube. But just one quick thing on this. I'm pretty sure this song came out less than a month ago. So the listener's concern about being behind the ball.
But I believe the YouTube video that listener Mark attached has like 14 million
mm-hmm.
views. So certainly people are getting on board with this.
Yes, but it came out that same exact YouTube video was posted on October 5th. So it seems to be skyrocketing. Good. I mean, something that's been out for less than a month, I don't think is like you're late to the party, certainly.
Considering my suggestion was from 1969, this is positively,
sure.
I mean, they just pressed this a minute ago, comparatively.
You know what? I'm looking at it just so that I don't play the wrong version and I play the one that you guys have chosen. I will play this link. There's no intro or anything on this YouTube video, right? I can just hit play on it?
I think so. I mean, when I previewed it, there was a, you know, some commercial. But as far as the song goes, I think it goes right into it. Anyway,
it's called
so this, but what
Dance
is it?
Monkey what? Is the name of the song. Dance Monkey is the name of the song. And the name of the band or musicians is Tones and I.
Okay. So that's Mark in Minnesota's suggestion, and that's going to bring us, of course, to the end of our broadcast week. Thank you so much, everybody, for spending the time with us. Thanks for being part of TBTL. Guess what, though? We're going to be right back here on Monday with more Imaginary Radio for you. So we will see you then. Until then, enjoy your weekend. Go Browns. Go Seahawks. Go eat a bagel. And please remember, no mountain too tall.
And good luck to all.
One more time. Ooh, I see you, see you, see you every time. And oh my, I like your style. Ooh, you make me wanna cry. And now I beg to see you dance just one more time. So I say, dance for me, dance for me, dance for me, oh, oh. I never seen anybody do the things you do. Boy, they say, move for me, move for me, move for me, hey, hey. And when you're done, I'll make you do it all again. I said, oh my God, I see you walking by. Take my hands, my dear, and look me in my eyes. Just like a monkey, I've been dancing my whole life. But you just beg to see me dance just one more.
Power out.